Welcome to the Packet Pushers Podcast. This is the weekly show. It is Greg and Ethan today, and we are going to chat about things that are different in 2017 versus 2016. Trends, companies, things that we think are interesting and notable going on. Starting out with SD-WAN, Greg. I mean, geez, if you look back at 2015 and 2016, we've recorded an awful lot of shows about SD-WAN, companies that were emerging from stealth or companies that were pivoting to take advantage of the SD-WAN craze. And now we've seen acquisitions, consolidation. Some companies have gone quiet. Some companies have been acquired by others. And we're in a different world now as far as SD-WAN goes. So if you were to pick out some trends, I have my opinions, but I'm curious to know what you think is really going on in that space.
Well, there's two things really I think that are worth talking about at first. First of all is we're starting to see a transition from SD-WAN being a product. So what I mean by that is you go out and you buy an SD-WAN box and you put that on your enterprise network and it replaces your router, or it looks like a router upgrade, right? Now, we did a lot of that in the early days. So I think there's two key things that we can start off the discussion around what's happening with SD-WAN in 2017, especially in the dying quarter, like this last quarter. And I think the first one is all of a sudden we're starting to see this transition from SD-WAN as a product to being more of a feature. Now, I remember back in 2015 and 2016, we were looking at vendors and startups in particular were out there selling these boxes that were kind of like replacements for your router. And they would be able to, you know, use an internet connection or multiple internet connections and replace your MPLS and that sort of thing. And I think...
Yeah, that was one of the ways that those were positioned. You didn't have to replace your router. And in fact, they would say, oh no, you can leave your router that terminates your WAN circuits right in there. That's fine if you want to, you don't have to. But right, the ultimate evolution would be, here's a little box that replaces your router. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the reason that they did that was because that's what we were used to. We always thought, like, there's a box there. We have to put a box. And so we have to, if we want to add something to the network, it has to be in a box. It has to come in a piece of tin wrapped up. And but what we're now starting to see is, and I posted about this recently, was Riverbed made an announcement about their SD-WAN. And all of a sudden, what we saw is they're talking about a box which is connecting to Azure. And the graphic that they put out went, you know, box on site, and it had DNS, DHCP, Wi-Fi, WAN acceleration, routing, and SD-WAN all in one box. And this, it sort of struck me that all of a sudden what we're looking at is that this idea that routing packets over the WAN connection is no longer a single thing. It's just something that everybody's got. And in fact, intelligent routing, if you want to think of SD-WAN as kind of like intelligent routing, has actually moved from being a box that you put in front of, you know, behind your router, or maybe as a router replacement. And then you keep your WAN accelerator and your branch Wi-Fi and your branch switch. And what's happening is they're all just folding into a single product.
Yeah. It's the branch in a box solution, because who wants to manage a whole stack of different boxes? So, you know, the remote offices that I have been dealing with in the past, it was that, oh, well, we're going to, I don't know, Cisco firewalls now. And so everybody get this little ASA box appropriately sized for their world. And then, oh, we're now a Riverbed shop. So everybody would get a little a Riverbed appliance out there to do WAN optimization and so on. And you end up with a stack of appliances doing all these functions. And it's a pain in the butt to manage. Who wants that? So, right, why would you do that with SD-WAN when you can have one box that does it all? So you mentioned Riverbed, and that makes sense. Yep. That plays to all of their strengths.
And I think that's where Cisco's heading too. Like, remember they bought Viptela, and we don't know what the Viptela acquisition will look like, but the current sort of stories that I'm hearing and coming out is that Viptela will be a function inside of the ISR router platforms that Cisco already sells.
Yeah, that is the expectation. And the ISR router platform can do virtualization. So sure, that can be a branch in a box solution. Plus, they've got some other appliances that play in that space too, where since we can virtualize all the things, put all the things into one box, one platform to manage that's got everything on it that you need to support that branch. So, and I think, you know, speaking of Viptela, that was something that early on when the Viptela acquisition announcement came out, you and I had hopped on a quick recording and speculated how hard would it be to actually integrate Viptela code into, you know, ISR, because it's not going to be native iOS code. I suspect it's going to be this thing off to the side that you got to route traffic into and out of inside that box. But it does appear to be the direction that things are headed from what we can gather from different people we know.
Yeah. The story I'm hearing is that Viptela will be the operating system. So you will have a choice to run the Viptela OS or your iOS XR, XE, whatever your favorite flavor is for that platform. I don't have it memorized anymore what the operating system is on ISRs. I think, and then they've also recently announced the ISR 1000, which is a whole different thing as well, which is a completely different router that's coming out from Cisco. And I think that platform in particular is sort of giving us some vision about how Cisco sees the future, because looks very much like a Viptela appliance, if you remember back. It has a Wi-Fi in it. It has a 3G/LTE antenna in it. And then it has a 8 ports or 12 ports in it. And I did a briefing in brief on this in the new podcast channel that we put together, where I just summarized some of the key features about that. So if you're interested, you should go and check that out. But I think that this box, Cisco's announcing that piece of hardware and getting custody, and they'll be out there, no doubt, you know, getting the resellers interested in it, and it will be running Viptela's operating system so that you can use the multipathing functionality. And I think what we're seeing is that vendors are saying, well, I don't want to be doing what Cisco's doing. I don't want to be trying to go head-to-head with Cisco, because you have to have something that adds value. So what Riverbed did with their thing, and I think we're seeing the same thing with other SD-WAN, like Silver Peak, you know, TeloIP, all the VeloCloud and those companies, they're all doing extras. So what they're now doing is deprecating this, you know, intelligent pathing function that we used to see as being absolutely core, and saying, sure, we do all that, but we do all this other stuff as well. We do DNS and DHCP. We do centralized management. We do, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Well, so to talk about Riverbed specifically, for a while there, you know, they went through a rebranding exercise. Not that they changed the name from Riverbed, but more saying, hey, we're an SD-WAN company now. That didn't stick. They didn't keep with that I can tell. If you go up on their website, they don't no longer say we're an SD-WAN company, which really speaks to your point. SD-WAN is one thing, and really the problem that you're trying to solve is a lot of things, at the branch. If you want to focus on where SD-WAN is going to make its money, it is in managing all of these different sites. SD-WAN isn't very exciting if it's a 5-site play. If it's a 500-site play or a 5,000-site play, then it's really neat. And so wouldn't you want to not just sell an SD-WAN box, but sell a box that does SD-WAN and a bunch of other things? And then ta-da, you've locked the customer in with all of the clever and amazing things you've done and the operational processes you've committed to. Yeah. If I was Riverbed, that's exactly how I do it. I wouldn't want to be the SD-WAN company. I'd want to be this company that does all of these amazing things for my branch and makes them easy to manage. And in fact, the last time we talked to Riverbed, they mentioned the SD-WAN along the way, but the big deal was integration with Azure cloud services for your branch locations, you know, for example.
Mm. I think this is the thing, is that it's customers hate their WANs. Like, if I look back at all the customers I've worked with over the years with 1,000 node or 2,000 node, you know, routed WANs that have got Cisco routers all over the place, they really hate them because they're so hard to live with.
So WANs are a management problem, and they're also a massively expensive problem. So, right. Hate them, but have to have them. And so anyone that's making that, as you've used the analogy of I have some pain, well, or I have a headache, well, here's headache medicine. You know, something to improve that experience is going to sell. But again, going back to our central point here, SD-WAN is just one of several problems that you're really trying to solve in that space.
Yeah, and I think it's a realization is that branches are no longer simple. They're actually quite often much more complex, and the arrival of the cloud is also changing the way it works. So it's not, if you've got a branch network, you don't want to be backhauling your traffic from your branch over a private WAN to the core and then backhauling it over an MPLS collection to Azure, you know, like or AWS on a direct connect. You want to connect directly to the cloud over an internet gateway.
But still have the inspection and all of the other compliance things that you need. I mean, a lot of people will blackhaul centrally because they need to inspect the traffic and so on. But so if you can distribute that functionality, which a lot of these platforms allow you to do that, that's a win.
Yes. And I think customers are looking for more than if you're suddenly connecting 1,000 branches to ADSL connections on the internet and multiple of them, you know, maybe an ADSL internet feed on an Ethernet port and then a 4G as a dial back, you know, as a backup connection to the internet or something like that. You need firewalls and proxy servers and email gateways and a whole bunch of other functions. So suddenly the SD-WAN edge isn't just about, you know, multiple IPsec connections over multiple internet pipes, you know, that you've bought for whatever purpose to the core or data center. It's actually now about application services. And I think even
it's building on the functionality, right? So, I mean, if you set the groundwork of a whole bunch of circuits, cheap bandwidth or whatever bandwidth I'm looking for and whatever flavor I'm looking for without me having to worry about building my own tunnels across it and managing them and dealing with encryption keys and all that stuff that we used to have to do back in the day, it's even beyond DMVPN, which was very popular because that was... And it is very popular because it's better than trying to manage all those tunnels, you know, one at a time. SD-WAN takes that even a step further. So now that you've got this easy to manage bandwidth on demand from multiple sources that you can abstract away, what else can we build on top of that now that we've got that problem solved?
Yeah, and you don't want to be, if I was somebody like Riverbed and historically I've been a WAN acceleration company, you know, and I've done a number of different things over the last few years. And the same applies to Silver Peak and, you know, F5. You know, what's F5 going to do now that load balancers are fundamentally dying? You know, I was reading up about Istio today. Have you been tracking Istio in the cloud?
I've been reading up on them a little bit, but not enough to have an opinion.
And they're basically load balancers, but they're just load balancers that DevOps wants, and it's free. Right. So, you know, these companies need to find more than just I'm a WAN accelerator, I'm a load balancer. They're all announcing that they're doing SD-WAN, but they're actually moving past that now and saying I'm doing DNS and DHCP. I'm doing file and print services for the branch. I've got firewalls, not that there's ever a definition for firewall. And because I've already got these application proxies in there, like especially WAN accelerators, they really know packets, right? They know flows and sessions and apps. And so now you've got this thing which is not a router. No, not a router. This is a branch in a box or a smart edge or, you know, all this sort of stuff that you can do. So it's really leapfrogging where Cisco, there's a chance here that Cisco might be, I'm coming out with an SD-WAN and Cisco's competitors have moved way past them into something else very different, which is much more complex and much more actually what customers want, I suspect.
It could be. I mean, I'll say that Cisco, with the customer base that they have and the success of the ISR, if they do the Viptela integration well, it's very possibly going to be quite successful for them. I mean, we had picked Viptela as an early winner, and therefore seeing them acquired by anybody, particularly Cisco, kind of underscores the success of that. So, can Cisco have a win here? Sure.
Is that what you're trying to say?
So not trying to pat ourselves in the back very hard, but more making the point that, you know, based on our review of the different products that were out there and the feedback we were getting from people that were deploying these solutions as we talked to different folks, we kind of had a sense that, okay, Viptela is a very strong player. They've got great technology. And so seeing Cisco finally acquire them makes a lot of sense on that. And now what is Cisco going to do with that? You know, I think Cisco is buying what they need to buy because, and this is something we knew going 2+ years ago, Viptela pitched against IWAN, Cisco's early SD-WAN entrant, IWAN, they were just losing those bake-offs left and right. Viptela was eating their lunch, which is something else we haven't actually mentioned yet, Greg, is what is the future of Cisco's IWAN product?
So I think there's a few things here. Cisco's not end-of-lifing IWAN as such. And I think it's a very complicated thing for some people to understand. Remember that IWAN isn't actually a separate thing. It's not like Cisco sat down and wrote IWAN. It's really a hodgepodge of existing Lego blocks. So a little bit of IPsec, a little bit of PFR, a little bit of routing protocols, a little bit of SLA. And of course, they didn't work together very well because Cisco really doesn't do a lot of cross-functional testing between the different elements. And so lots of people had problems with IWAN. And then there was supposed to be a software platform above it, and they sort of danced a little bit with Glue and a little bit with Live Action for visibility, Glue Networks to do provisioning. They did some stuff with their own APIC controller and some Prime, and they sort of didn't sort of commit to it. I sort of got a sense that Cisco wanted. There was a part of Cisco that wanted to do this SD-WAN. They knew it was going to be a thing, but the bits and pieces inside of Cisco kept sort of fighting with each other, and each business unit wasn't quite getting it together. And in the end, they went out and bought Viptela for $600 million, almost like with very little fanfare, and they just, boom, it was done. And I think ultimately what's going to happen is IWAN's not dead. So Cisco hasn't gone in and gone, no more IPsec in iOS, no more PFR, no, because people are using those features all over the place. But I think what they are saying is, we are not going to develop IWAN as a solution package that you can go and buy a reference architecture and an APIC EM controller and do all the stuff. No, that's finished. We're going to go with Viptela. And the reason they're going with Viptela is because of the public cloud. So I think Meraki has shown the success of this public cloud with some on-prem stuff. We saw Cisco announce its Insight product this week, where they've been put a cloud platform that can manage all the UCS chassis. And Viptela's got the same thing. They've got this cloud management engine hosted in the public cloud, which can reach down into the WAN and do the asset management and the automated configuration. And
yeah, but is
the
that that hard, really? I mean, I don't know that that would be the biggest driver for Cisco to have done the Viptela acquisition. Simply the management platform. I think it's more the success in actually getting the product deployed. You know, the problem that IWAN customers had, particularly early ones, was just how brutally difficult it was to get it deployed and get it working the way it was intended to work. So if you step back and go, well, okay, how do we make this actually function the way it's intended to function, where particular applications are getting sent across particular paths in accordance with a policy SLA that the customer has defined? Well, if you want to do that with IWAN, there's APIC and so on that you can make it. Mm-hmm. Early on, there wasn't as much APIC to help you with that. And Viptela just made that a lot easier. So I think that's a piece of it. I don't know, because so many companies are doing cloud-based management. Mm-hmm. How hard would it have been for Cisco to do that? They have some of that technology, all of that technology in-house already in a variety of forms.
But it takes Cisco so long to bring new features into those platforms. I think looking back, if Cisco could have done that, it would have. They tried to make IWAN work. They tried to iterate. But I feel that Cisco's internal development cycles are really slow. They just take far too long. And they don't seem to be able to modernize and start working at like a monthly cadence to produce high quality, high reliability. They used to thump out a release. We still hear people talking about bugs in just core competencies.
Well, we heard this yesterday in the Packet Pusher Slack channel. A lot of people talking about just the frustration that they're having with bugs. I hate to say Cisco, because I don't think it's just them, but I mean, they are the ones that are cited very often where there is a production impacting bug on a monthly cadence, depending on the product. It's not just, IWAN, which is our context now, but, a variety of products. So there does seem to be some software development challenges within Cisco that I think happen to get a lot of attention, because so many people that are in networking or listen to this show use Cisco products.
Well, if you've been a long time Cisco client or Cisco customer, that's where you're going to go first. That's perfectly natural and, the right thing to do. But when you start to get down to it, if you start to experience pain, how far down the pain, what's your pain threshold for deploying a technology? But I think the point here is that Viptela is the future. They've got an operating system that works, that's got the features. They've got a cloud platform. It gives Cisco time to market. And I think there's one other part about this, and that's why IWAN is definitely dead, just because Cisco hasn't been able to make it work internally. Chuck Robbins gave it its chance. It didn't do it. It couldn't do it. And so they made a decision. And, when you spend $600 million on Viptela, you can't keep having two SD-WAN strategies. The market, the stock, the shareholders aren't going to let you.
I mean, because I tend to agree with that. That is the most likely outcome. How the technical implementation shakes down will be very interesting to me. Mm. If they actually run it as an OS on the ISR platform, that will be fascinating, as opposed to, I think it's iOS XE, and then as a module or a virtual machine that's off to the side.
It's hard to imagine that iOS XE can do this sort of stuff. The operating system, the actual underlying operating system, may be Linux, but Cisco has done so much customization of the Linux kernel. Like I heard somewhere someone say that the kernel inside that is like 7 or 8 years old, and they just don't modernize it because they don't need to. They've locked it all down. All that work's done. So that's finished. They're never going to touch that for another 10 years. That's sort of the inside mindset. So, and I think the other thing that's happening here, which we haven't talked about a lot because we're so enterprise focused, is we're seeing a lot of carriers and managed service providers bring out SD-WAN products. So what they're now partnering with is companies like VeloCloud and SD-WAN providers like Riverbed, and saying, yeah, we know that you're finished with your MPLS networks, but here's what we can do. We can give you an MPLS and an internet connection, provide you with a managed SD-WAN service. And that is just unbelievably huge. I think a lot of the reason that the enterprises aren't hearing about SD-WAN so much is because all of the people who are into, all of the vendors who make SD-WAN have gone off to talk to carriers and managed service providers. So we've seen things like Comcast has got an SD-WAN service. BT's got a managed...
Master G, someone that pops up on our radar. There's a company called Atlantic.net that I think is in there. But it all goes back to the point that you made very early on about, holy crap, dealing with my, I hate my WAN. I don't want to deal with this problem anymore. So you outsource it. Yeah. And then now, SD-WAN is, that means your managed WAN offerings now include an SD-WAN capability that you as an end customer can take advantage of without having to worry about it. It's a feature that your managed service provider is offering to you.
Yeah, and I think, actually, I do believe if customers were to do that, they'd be doing themselves a disservice. I understand the attraction of having one throat to choke, but the disadvantage of one throat to choke is that they've got you over a barrel, right, at the same time. So if you buy everything from a single supplier, you have to take whatever they give you and suck it up. And on one hand, it can reduce your workload, and on the other hand, it makes it a lot worse, because every time you have a problem, they just sit there and look at you and go like, you're locked in for 5 years. Where are you going to go? Signed a contract.
Depends on the MSP. I mean, yes, you have a point, but it is the most cynical outlook. I mean, there are some MSPs that the reason they exist is because they are looking out for their end customers. So they're not trying to screw you because you signed the five-year term sheet.
I don't think they intend to screw you. I think it's a natural outcome of them locking you in, right? They have to do that because they have to invest heavily to roll out these things. And they have to buy all the boxes, and then they're going to rent them to you, like that sort of thing. And then they have to build an entire platform to manage them, and then scaling up the management platform and blah, blah, blah. And I believe some of them actually think they're doing a good thing, or at least their salespeople think they are because they're told to think that way. But ultimately, the biggest cost in your network is not the routers or the branches. It's the travel out to sites, and you can solve the site travel by having a 4G out-of-band connection to your SD-WAN appliance. So there's your whole, if your physical line goes down, the 4G is going to give you a backup, right? And that's the whole point. That's what made routers really difficult, is you could only afford to buy one MPLS connection or buying two of them, but where's your backdoor if something goes wrong? And a lot of these devices are new, they're modern, they have multiple copies of the OS, they don't struggle to update themselves, right? Like we used to see in the old days. And I think that the ability to have two carriers in the room and then bang their heads together on pricing, that's where the money is. 70% of a networking budget is the carrier of your WAN if you're using private WAN bandwidth. If you can get rid of the carrier, you can cut 50% out of your networking budget, out of your WAN budget.
Another big problem here. It's not just you controlling and having multiple carriers in the room. Yes, there's an advantage for that if you're a certain kind of company. There are a lot of companies that are using managed service providers because they don't want to have the technical expertise in-house to deal with that. They can't afford it, or they just don't want the overhead.
But the reason that we got rid of the technical expertise was because it was so hard to do that yourself. So giving it away to a big company, outsourcing it, made sense. Now you can bring it back in and do it better than your outsourcer can. The technology's changed, right?
Maybe. It definitely depends on the profile of the company in question.
Yes. And this is the same story as if I go back into the days of mainframes. Companies used to buy mainframes, and then they said, running mainframes is very difficult. So they put the mainframes into bureaus, which was basically colos. This is back in the 80s and 90s. And then companies ran the mainframes. And then eventually the mainframes got so cheap, it was actually cheaper to bring the mainframe back into the office. It actually was microcomputers. And so then you had them. And then, of course, microcomputers were replaced by x86s and so on and so forth. And now we've got cloud. It's this ebb and flow backwards and forwards. I believe right now that relying on a single supplier for your WAN, whether it's internet or not, you're probably going to get the best value for money by not buying it from a managed service provider or carrier. You should think about, I'm going to go and buy my own, manage my own, and then bang carriers' heads together. Because that's the cloud way of doing things.
And just having gone through that cycle with one of the companies I've worked with over the years, I'll say that when you've got another carrier you can work with, even if you've got an existing locked-in contract that's not supposed to expire for another year or something, you can get that contract changed when you've got that other carrier to use as leverage. Well, Greg, let's move the conversation ahead. You had written up something because you stumbled across, of all things, port extenders and 802.1 BR. And I'm like, geez, I deployed something like that back in 2008 or 10, and I haven't really thought much about it since. It seems like it's technology that's there. And, I think of Cisco Fexes with that as maybe the most typical example of such technology. I was even trying to remember if their solution with the Fexen was 802.1br compliant or not, and so on. But what the heck did you run into that brought this back to your mind?
So I track a bunch of blogs, and one of them is Marvell's networking blog. Now, Marvell is a manufacturer of ASICs and silicon for switches. And they popped up with a blog post just 2 or 3 months ago saying 802.1br is the duck's guts and everybody should be using it. And my initial reaction was like, what the? And then the other one. So the idea behind 802.1br was back in 2010, I remember talking to people inside of the then HP networking. And the idea was that they were working with the IEEE and they were saying, if we're going to have multiple VMs in a server, how do we get the networking traffic into the switch? So their idea was that all the packets would come out of a VM, they'd go into the switch, come back through the ASIC, and then come back into the VM next to it, right? And the idea was that all of your access lists, all of your Ethernet filters, all of your SNMP polling would then be seen in the switch. So that was one part of 802.1br. And then the second part of that is, once you're forcing all your traffic to loop through the silicon, why don't you make it so that if you have a port on a switch, have it so that it actually goes up to the ASIC further up. So it bounces straight up to the switch above it. And then share the ASIC from a bigger switch upstream. So we saw that with the Nexus 5000s and the Nexus 2000s is the one
exactly.
That most
yeah,
people...
The 2000s couldn't do any local switching. It was pretty much a dumb device. They were dirt cheap per port. So if you had copper facing, you'd plumb those up. You'd use the uplink ports, set up some kind of an oversubscription ratio that you were happy with for your traffic profile. All the traffic would go from the 2K, hit the uplink ports, be switched in the 5K that was upstream to wherever it was headed. And if it so happened that your host-to-host comms was actually happening in the 2K, that traffic was still going down through the 5K because no local switching. And again, the big advantage being per port, way cheaper to put a 2K in the rack than it would be to put a layer 2 or layer 3 catalyst full-blown switch with its own ASICs in it.
Yeah, but we've seen a substantial transition over the last couple of years where the price of the switch is now much cheaper than it was back then. So I can remember the Nexus 5000 was like $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 for a full unit, and a 2K would actually come in at sort of $10,000. Is that about right, your recollection?
Dependent on the model and so on. But yes, the cost differential was substantial between a 5K and a 2K, absolutely.
Right. And so now what we've got is a situation where those 48 ports of 10 gig is now down under $5,000. So the cost of the switch has changed. We don't need fabric extension anymore, or these port bridges, or these port extenders anymore, because you could just buy a switch. And
I suppose that depends on what Fexes are going for today. If we're talking about Cisco kind of stuff, yeah. I don't actually know the cost profile, but I mean, with so much cost sunk into optics, that doesn't change.
So remember that most Cisco UCS servers use Fex as well. So you can configure the VIX on a UCS to loop the traffic up through.
Yep.
Cisco really got behind this idea as a way of maximizing the value of the core switch, which makes sense because that's what they wanted. They wanted the network to be in control of everything, and that was the value that they added. But what's happened, of course, is that virtual switching or software switches are now just as fast as physical switches, within certain limits, right? You're sorting just about any server on the market today can do 10 gigabits per second of forwarding, quite often 40, and we're seeing some people do 100 gigabits per second inside of servers. And then Intel came out with DPDK, which gave you hardware acceleration in an x86 platform. We're seeing intelligent network adapters from various vendors. Mellanox is a very popular choice, and they're talking about doing line rate 100 gigabits per second using hardware acceleration on their cards. So all of a sudden, I can do virtual switching at sort of the sort of performance that I got in switches. That was one thing. The second thing is that the highest cost in a switch now, especially a large number of ports connected, is in the SFP modules. So
yes, yep.
If I'm going to buy a cheap switch, it doesn't actually change the overall cost of the solution when I still need to buy 48 by 10 gig SFP optics.
Right. Right, exactly.
Right? So for the first thing that we did, virtual switches started to make the point of control inside the server, inside the virtual switch, instead of inside the network. So all of a sudden, the idea of sending the Ethernet traffic out from the VM to the network to be counted, controlled, and ACL'd and all that has just gone. That NSX has showed that doesn't work. ACI, the endpoint groups can be virtual or physical. And And all of the other vSwitches out there do the same thing. So that's done.
But not that it doesn't work, that you don't need to do it that way.
Yeah. And then the second biggest factor was reducing the cost of the switch. Well, switching ASICs have come down in price dramatically, right? We're down to 16 nanometer or 12 nanometer production. The price is so low, I actually don't need to preserve the cost of ASIC ports anymore. Broadcom Trident chipsets are cheap, and we've got Barefoot Tofino. We've got a whole bunch of, Marvell has its ASICs. We've got Cavium X-Pliants out there. They're not precious little, bandwidth is cheap. We have so much bandwidth, we just don't need to fetch with it anymore. And so that's what struck me about this. It was like, oh, I guess they've got a sunk investment here, right? If I was Marvell, I'd have a sunk investment in this thing. And, maybe I can convince. Anyway, that's what I thought.
It's a niche product to me at this point. In a world where in the data center, you were very typically doing leaf spine and you are running L3 as far as up to the host itself, your port extender doesn't help you at all, really. It's not a solution that is really doing much for you anymore. I mean, I look at it as if you don't want to pull back in the day, the decision was, it's like, well, if you don't want to put a full-blown switch out there, here's some way cheaper per port. And I don't know that for all the reasons you just said, I don't know that equation holds together for too many people. I'm trying to think of different solutions where, you'd still be throwing FEX out there. And it's more old school style data centers thinking more north-south, where you probably got to pump traffic down there anyway. A lot of modern data center designs, particularly if you've got folks that are trying to go cloud native inside your data center, the traffic managers wouldn't even make sense for that. You wouldn't want to do it that way. You would want to do leaf spine with full switching capability right in the tour. You certainly could be doing layer three right up to the host. I wouldn't say probably. I think that's still emerging. But where you'd want to be able to switch at layer three right from the get-go, right out of the gate, not shoving something down the line two hops away so it can be switched locally and brought back. And it doesn't make any sense.
I remember when we looked at NSX back in 2012 and we just thought, like, that'll never work. You can't process that many packets. And I remember thinking that, right? And like, as you go further and further back, I think right in 2011, I got briefed by what was then Nasir. And I just thought, there's no way a server can do switching in the local machine. There's just not enough CPU performance. It's going to be latent. But turns out over time that things change faster than I could reasonably expect, acceleration.
Lots of CPU and lots of bus speed now. Bus speed continues to grow with PCIe. So that's,
all driver renaissance and x86 chips, really, in a way. And now talking about doing 40 gigabit per second with a single core out of, I don't know, can't remember the details anymore, but doesn't take a whole big hit to forward a lot of packets out of one of these things. Just struck me about that. It's sort of like a summary of, like, this is something that should have died, but it just reminded me how far we've come. So again, looking back over the last couple of years, I think this thing is that everybody should be having 10 gig ports, probably 25 gig. And these nasty hacks that we put in place back in the days when switches were expensive, well, switches aren't expensive now, and we need to treat them as cheap consumable items that we pick up and throw them in the bin when they don't work.
Well, let's do some ads, Greg. And I don't mean ads like somebody's paid us, but just some things that we wanted to raise for people's attention. One is just some webinars that we're doing. Well, actually, one of which I guess we are working with the sponsor for that. But I'm doing one with Ivan Pepelniak's IPspace.net on QoS fundamentals. And the background of this is I contributed to a book with Russ White on computer networking problems and solutions. And I wrote a chapter. I wrote several chapters, but I wrote a chapter on QoS. And so, long story short, we're turning that chapter on QoS fundamentals that's in that book into a webinar that I'll be presenting. It's in early November. So if you go to Ivan's website, ipspace.net, and click around, I'm sure you'll find that and can register for that if you like. And I think if you're a subscriber, you get it for free. And I've already written the chapter, so I have all the material there. I just got to build some slides for you nice people so you can listen to me go on for 2 hours and ask questions about all that stuff. And by the way, since I mentioned a book, the book that Russ and I, along with other contributors, have put together is supposed to be out at the end of 2017, the very end, last I heard. Like, you might be able to get it on December 29th, I think, was the last date I saw. I haven't gotten anything official from the publisher yet telling us that that is exactly when that book's going to drop, but we'll let you know when it's out there and you can read Russ and, to a lesser degree, myself, going on and on about network design and how different computer tech or different networking technologies are applied to specific business problems, and gives you a way to think about how to use networking tech and not be intimidated by something new because it's probably like something you've heard before. So you're doing a webinar with a company called IB Wave, Greg?
That's right. So IB Wave is a company that does wireless surveys. They're about design, how you could take designing of a different space, especially at large scale. So enterprise scale, stadium scale. And they have this ability where you can walk around and use a cloud platform and do your wireless network designs ahead before you actually do it. Now, a lot of people, I'm a huge fan of these things. Having done a couple of wireless networks, I'm not a wireless expert by comparison to some of the people that we've met through Field Day, but, you know, really, these guys are doing some interesting stuff. So we're going to be doing a webinar about wireless surveys in a couple of weeks. It's up on October the 25th, I think. October 31st, we're going to be doing it. There'll be a link in the show notes. If you haven't seen it, keep us an eye out for us on Twitter. Webinar is kind of fun. So often we get to do some cool stuff that we're thinking about.
Yeah, by the time this show comes out and you've downloaded it and are listening to it, I will have done one with live action about SD-WAN monitoring that you might want to dig around and go look for the archives of that one. Because it's all about, you know, you're a level away with SD-WAN from the circuits and protocols you love. And what if you really want to monitor down deep and see what the heck is going on? And live action has a solution for that. So, right, I'm doing... by the time this show comes out, I will have done that webinar with them at Live Action. Mm. Something else we've introduced, Greg, is Briefings in Brief. These are 5-minute podcasts that are summaries of briefings that we've taken from vendors. Vendors want to brief us all the time about this, that, and the other thing. We don't take most of the briefings because most of the news, frankly, isn't that interesting. But when something comes, I was like, ooh, that could be cool. We'll listen to them. And if it does turn out indeed that what they said was cool or interesting or something we think that's worth passing along, we'll record just a few minutes about it, so you get everything that was interesting about the briefing condensed down into a nice, tight format, and and then give you a jump-off point so you can go click around and learn more if whatever we were talking about and whatever we heard about in that briefing was interesting to you.
Now, what's important about Briefings in Brief, it's actually a separate channel, so it's not part of the fat pipe. So if you're one of these people who subscribe to the main things, it's actually going to be separate. So you'll need to head up to your favorite podcatcher and search for Briefings in Brief from the Packet Pushers and subscribe separately. So if you're at Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, whatever it is, Sonos, you are going to need to go and find it. To tune into it, to get it into your feed so that you can see it come out. We've sort of got to the point where the fat pipe is just publishing so much content that people are kind of overloading. And so we didn't want to keep throwing more and more at you. So you'll just have to subscribe separately. I'm sorry.
We know. We've been putting out like for quite a while now, 4 shows a week, plus now the Briefings in Brief. And right, so we just couldn't thump it all into the fat pipe, but you guys just get beyond just sick of listening to me and Greg and Chris and Scott and Drew, you know, going on and on. We're sorry. We get it.
We get it. So we thought we'd give you a chance to opt in. If you want to.
That's
right. Maybe you've had enough of us by now, and that might be so. If you're interested in that, it literally is 5 minutes. So far, we've done 6 of them, and none of them are longer than 5 minutes. So we're quite proud of that one. That's pretty good.
Okay, moving on to new topics that where we think things have significantly changed, or you know, the needles move between last year and this year, 2017, is visibility analytics coupled with machine learning. So we've talked to a bunch of companies here. Kentik is one. They've been a sponsor on the show. Nokia Deepfield, another sponsor on the show. Cisco with their Tetration product fits into this world as well. They're not a sponsor yet, although we are actually talking to them about coming on board too. So Kentik, Deepfield, Tetration, and other players in the space are taking data from the network. They are looking at inbound data that's flowing in typically with streaming analytics, although they can take polling data as well, and then analyzing that data in a way that they find trends and they find interesting things going on in the network and then present that to you. That could be in the form of troubleshooting. That could be in the form of, I'm trying to figure out why last night something was really slow or some link was overloaded, and they can give you those sorts of answers. So, and they each have their specialties. They, DeepField would talk about their cloud genome, where they can identify endpoints very clearly, so you understand the source and or destination of a flow. Kentik is hot with things like BGP analytics, where they can tell you from this autonomous system to that across this link, you saw this sort of flow data going through, and tell you things like, Netflix was hammering you, and if you, and then you know things like, oh, if I change my BGP policies, I can help control that, et cetera. DeepField would talk about changing the links, or maybe using some kind of a policy that could divert traffic from one heavily used link to one that's lesser used, because it's got the insights there telling you what's really going on. And machine learning is a part of that trend, where data is being pushed through an analytics machine learning algorithm. That machine learning is being trained with data sets and gets smarter and smarter over time to make inferences that are actually useful. And we've talked to a lot of these shops now where they've been doing their darndest to convince us that it's not just machine learning washing that they're doing. Yes, we put a rubber stamp on it and it's now machine learning, but there's actually truly machine learning algorithms going on in the background. So that is something that is truly changing, where it's not just SNMP, I poll every 5 minutes and I put a pretty graph on the screen, but it's sucking data from the network, often using streaming telemetry, and then making inferences about that data for you, so that you're not having to sit and parse through the data yourself, which is bloody impossible because there's too much information. You as a human can't do that, but software can.
And it's really exciting here, because what these people are doing is actually managing vast data lakes. So key part about machine learning isn't just having machine learning algorithms, although that's really important. The other really, really important thing is having vast lakes of data, just petabytes of data to analyze and pull patterns out, because everybody's network is actually the same. And when you take the data and you analyze it, you'll start to see the same thing happen in everybody's network. You know why your network is the same? Because we all have the same skills and we apply them to all of our networks. Don't believe the lies that salespeople tell you about every customer is unique. Every network is a special flower. It's like a snowflake. It's rubbish.
They may be plumbed together differently, but we're all sharing the same kind of data sets as our traffic flows
everybody
across.
Everybody runs IP and Ethernet. Nobody's, if your network was a true snowflake, everybody would be running a unique protocol.
Speaking about DeepField, that one of the things that they do is, again, that Cloud Genome Project, where they're mapping data from across the world, from a different collection points within their customer base. So they've anonymized the data, so it's there's security and anonymity there and privacy, but then they're analyzing global trends based on all of that, and then using that data as you put it, a data lake. You know, that data lake is then mined globally to present trends for everybody, so that you can infer more correctly what's actually going on your network based on what they've figured out has been going on everyone else's network too.
Yeah, and I think the other thing we're seeing now is, so this is visibility, right? But what we're also seeing is another type of visibility, which is this modeling based on these companies like Veriflow and Forward Networks, and there's a couple of others in the back room coming out as well, where they reach into your network, read the configuration, and then build an absolute model of the network. And what they're doing is they're using a branch of mathematics called formal verification. So they can actually map all of the paths through the network, like ACLs, routing, read the BGP configuration, and then test the path through the network to see if something works. And then you can go into the web interface and say, if I wanted to go from here to here, what are all the paths possible? And it'll show them all to you. Or it'll show you where the paths break. And maybe packets aren't traveling the way you thought they might. This is really interesting for me anyway.
Well, we've talked to Veriflow at some length. We actually recently published a Future of Networking show with Brighton Godfrey, one of the founders at Veriflow, and got a lot of insight into what's going on there. It is interesting because, again, it goes towards that notion of you as a human can't figure it all out. So me as an engineer, as I would work on different segments of whatever the latest network was that I'd inherited, I would learn exactly how it would forward, how the routing protocols were, where the adjacencies were, what the circuits were, and so on. But there's a point where your brain can't remember it all and can't keep it all straight. And no matter how good you are, you might be able to go, well, if this circuit goes down, traffic's going to converge like this. And you might be right. But what takes the guesswork out of it? What takes the human, I think it's going to go like this part away, is that model that looks at exactly what the state of the network is. And then it gives you the opportunity to put a proposed change in. I want to change things like this, and then validate that traffic is going to flow through the network the way you think it is going to. So, right, we keep mentioning Veriflow because I think we've talked to them most recently, but also forward networks very much in that state. A shortcoming I did want to raise with this, Greg, you know, one kind of a, not a negative, but just a limitation or a constraint of this modeling is this is all about software. So one complaint that some people have had, you know, about these solutions are they don't take into account hardware, ASIC limitations, things like how a line card behaves in a particular chassis switch with this particular software running on it. You can't really model that with most of these solutions that are out there. I think some maybe attempt some of that stuff. But generally speaking, this is all about software and how that software is going to forward that traffic.
They have to, the way that sort of, now this is a gross oversimplification, these people read the network configuration out of multiple devices, firewalls, routers, switches, you know, they have to read ACLs, routing, you know, BGP table states, LDP, LLDP, you know, there's so many things that they have to read. And then they have to turn that into an intermediate language, which their own system can speak so that they can then read, you know, Juniper, Cisco, all the different flavors of Junipers and the Ciscos and the Brocades and the Extremes and the blah, blah, blah. And so you have one part about this, which is the data gathering engine. And then you have the internal mathematical engine, which then is the internal language, which tries to, and what they're struggling with, as I understand it, is just in the amount of variety of devices that's out there. So, A, stop buying so many different devices. Just stabilize. Your network is probably a snowflake because you've bought so much stuff and you haven't gotten rid of the old stuff. Anyway, different problem. So there is that part of it, and that's what it is. But the I'm just so inspired by these things because the thing that I think about these models is they're really, really exciting in terms of where they lead into with intent-based networking. And because these systems are actually just a software model of the network, you can actually say, I want to put this here. Now tell me what happens to the network. Does this break? Does traffic go into a black hole? So, you know, normally you have to sit down and think about all the BGP configuration and the neighbors and what if the route and if there's redistribution here and, you know, all those sorts of things. These people can take the config of the network. You can go into it and say, if I add this router here, put this config, what happens? And it can then do the tests for you and validate that it will do what you think it does. Now, if you think about that, all of a sudden now you've got a model of your enterprise network, thousands of devices. You can add a device, validate it, and then send it out to site with a pretty high level of confidence that it's going to work. So that leads into an automation cycle where, and I think this is where these companies are going to be very valuable in terms of being acquired by people, is if you've got an intent-based networking system, you want to have a software model, but before you configure something, you want to validate that the change is legit, that it's going to do what you think it does. It's going to capture your intent correctly, and you want to have a bunch of tests to prove that that intent is going to work as you want, right?
Yeah, and in fact, if you talk to Veriflow, that is part of their current messaging. They will say, is the intent of the customer being fulfilled through this particular configuration? And part of their interface is intents that are, you know, working, things that are not matching intent, you know, and so on.
Intent
so
number one, will it work? Intent number two, will it work the way I thought?
So I just want to wrap up this one topic, just making a, you know, really important point here, or important to me anyway, and that is, in the past, as we've had, you know, monitoring solutions, network monitoring stations that have done SNMP polling and syslog aggregation and so on, just barfing all this data flowing, all these messages and data points flowing in from the network, it's been up to us as engineers to try to make sense of it. What the heck's going on? Where we're headed and what we're seeing now with these visibility analytics solutions, with machine learning, with modeling as well, is getting down to what's really broken and having software tell us root cause,
yes,
what's really going on. That is the massive thing that I am the most excited about with all of these tools,
yes,
is the that ability to see on a screen, I think this is the thing that's broken in your world, and, you know, boom, here it is, to get right to it. Rather than parsing through dozens or hundreds or thousands or more messages trying to make sense of what the heck happened when something wasn't working right at 2:34 in the morning.
Yep. So another company that's doing this is Apstra. They're doing it slightly differently. They're actually using graph technology to do this. But what they're actually doing is, now the thing about these other ones that we talked about is they're static. They read the configuration of the network. They might read it over and over and over, whatever. But the a thing about what Apstra is doing with their intent is that you're feeding in data all the time. So part of their engine is, this is what your network configuration is, and it's going out and reading from the network, but it's also taking telemetry information to say, this is the transient state or the temporal state or the, you know, this is what's actually happening here now. This network is overloaded here. And its long-term goal is to be able to react to transient problems in the network. So if this link here is overloaded, well, why don't I start steering traffic around the congestion? Or this link has failed, well, I need to do something about this. And it has a bunch of learned or models on how it's going to react to known situations. And this is where real intent-based networking has come from. This is why, at this point in time, I think Cisco's decision to go forward with Lisp probably limits their vision of intent-based networking to sort of where they should have been a couple of years ago, not where they're going to be. I think startups are going to move past Cisco fairly rapidly here, and we'll see Cisco do like a Viptela acquisition here. But I think that what we need to understand is that these intent-based networking systems not only should be, here's my intent, translate it, do the configuration, they also need to read our intent as the network changes over time. So if your WAN connection changes, or if the data center overloads, or there's a burst of traffic, or your distributed storage system suddenly, you know, you lose 10 systems out of 40 in a petabyte class array, you need to change the traffic profile in your network. We saw Plexi do something like this with its dynamic DWDM backbone to be able to sort of monitor intent and re-architect the backbone to react to these temporal changes or these transient changes in the network traffic load, right?
Plexi's still around, by the way. I mean, so much of what they did was a bit ahead of its time, and, you know, predated a lot of the solutions that are popping up now.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, they're still out there talking with a lot of people, and from what I hear, closing big deals. So if you've forgotten about Plexi and they just popped up, you know, in your mind, yeah, you know, they're another one that actually, they haven't gone the route of intent washing, which, by the way, the best friggin' thing that maybe comes out of intent-based networking is Cloud Toad's video on YouTube where he demonstrates intent washing. It's the best thing ever, and if you're listening to the show and you haven't, just search for Derek Winkworth or Cloud Toad and intent washing and find that video on YouTube and enjoy those 2 or 3 minutes of your life. However, it will definitely improve your day. Awesome.
Yes. It was. I did laugh. I must say,
it's just priceless. It's great stuff.
I blogged it on Ethereal Mind these days.
It's marketing for Apstra, but, you know, hey, it's worth your time. Great stuff.
Indeed. So all of this talk about modeling and formal verification and data lakes and visibility has led me to come up with this rather grand taxonomy of intent-based networking. Can we talk about that now?
Oh, Lord, am I going to have to second guess you, or is this like a down-to-earth, serious thing?
I like to think it's pretty serious. So first of all, intent-based networking, you are definitely going to get intent washing, and people are all going to claim that their product is intent-driven. And I think what we've talked about for the last gosh knows how long, half an hour, is the fact that you need machine learning, data lakes, you need models derived from machine learning, you need formal verification and models to be able to know what your network should look like if you implement this intent and to test and validate. You also need to be able to get streaming telemetry from the network so that you can adapt your intent into something that's changing. And so that if something changes now, then you need to undo that change later when something fixes or whatever. So if a device fails, what is your network going to do? So these are all things that are going to happen. So I think, have you tracked into autonomous vehicles? They talk about the different levels of autonomous vehicles, class 0 to class 5.
Right. Whether it's just something that is, you know, it's got like a Subaru, they've got this system called EyeSight, and it can help you with things like, oh, you're leaving your lane, and, you know, and so on. But it's not a system that replaces the driver. It helps the driver. But then as you get into the higher levels, there's more and more autonomy.
So the Tesla self-driving system is a class 3. It works on the highway, but the driver is still supposed to take ownership and be responsible for the vehicle. They still need a license, and legal liability rests with the driver, not with the car, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and so on. And then there's another state after that. And then the final one is that cars are fully autonomous and there's no steering wheel. So that's called class 5.
So, what you've done is built a stages of intent-based networking that are kind of sort of like the different stages you can have or levels of autonomous cars.
So this is what I mean, is I think intent-based networking. So when we started out on this section about intent, it's a journey. It's not a thing. You can't go and buy an IBN. It's like you can't buy an SDN. It's a journey. Now, software-defined networking gave us is a predicate or the predecessor to intent. Once we're able to configure our networks via software, what do we then want to do? We want to dynamically reconfigure them with software. And that, to me, is like the intent-based networking is the evolution beyond that. Now, for those of you rolling your eyes and going, Greg and Ethan, enough, sure, it's a long strategy and it's not going to be, but you can buy pieces of this today. So I think it's going to work out in 6 phases. Stage 0 is what you've got today, manual operations, finger banging the keyboard until your fingers are bloody stumps and hoping that you get it accurate, correct, and mostly right. Fair? Step 1, automation, right? You're going to whip out your Python and pick out your favorite library, your Ansible, your Salt Stack, your Napalm, and what you're going to do is take your manual operations and basically automate those with a big script. Happy days, right? So all you're doing is making your scripts, well, what I call superhuman. If you can take your CLA and make it better than what a human can do, then you've achieved superhuman. Does that make sense? I mean, a lot of people don't quite get that superhuman means better than human. Yeah.
It's fair enough. And I think that's a fair analogy. You're going to take some kind of a script and try to standardize your operations by automating those things that you do over and over again. And you may try to integrate some of that into an orchestration system and so on. But I look at most of the Python and Napalm, Python using Napalm, et cetera, as a way to, right, you're definitely leveling up from your level 0 of manual operations and moving into a level 1 where you've done some automation. But it's still very manual, and there's an anticipation that there's a human being driving that intent based on what's in their head, as opposed to telling software, go forth and make me something.
Yes. So, but it doesn't fundamentally re-engineer the process.
No.
Just because because instead of you hitting a hammer with your fleshy, and you're a fleshy robot bringing the hammer up and down, you put it in a machine that bangs the hammer on the steel to make a sword, that doesn't necessarily transform the process, if you know what I'm saying.
Not especially. So, hopefully you've reduced the errors. Hopefully you've made it faster and more consistent in your result. But no, we haven't moved the needle that far yet.
No, but it substantially transforms, changes the way operation works, improves accuracy, speed, and there's an awful lot of money being made out of automation today. The second phase is what we're seeing now, which is this visibility and visualization piece. So we just talked about DeepField and Kentik and all the people using Yang models and streaming telemetry, gRPC and OpenConfig. We've been, Juniper's making a huge effort inside of its devices to be able to stream vast amounts of telemetry out of Junos reliably, predictably, like not just some devices. When you start to light up all of the telemetry, they just fall over because the internal software architectures are incompetent. They're not designed that way. And they've just sort of slapped this Yang model on top and said, we'll stream it out over gRPC. And then all of a sudden the software can't cope because it's not stress tested to transmit that amount of data. And so I think the visibility, the visualization, this is this capability where we can get visibility through modeling. So we just talked about formal verification, taking models and seeing that gives us a new generation of visibility. We're also seeing people like Kentik and DeepField give us, using other forms of telemetry flow data and machine learning, to give us more visibility. So now all of a sudden, we know what's actually happening in our network. It's not trace route. It's not ping. It's not polled data from an SNMP on a 5-minute interval. It's sub-second stream telemetry being fed into vast data lakes. And now you really know what's going on in your network. So that's level 2, right?
It's interesting that you break that up into the two components, because I think you could argue that we don't need the flow data element of that the verification is the key part with the modeling, where you're demonstrating that you are compliant with a given intent by looking at the model of what actually exists on the network. You're closing the loop, essentially. And as a network engineer at level zero, you'd be doing show run commands to demonstrate that, you know, some, or a show commands to demonstrate that the configuration you'd put in actually came out the way you wanted.
Yeah,
you do manual verification.
Point, you're
We're
not
talking
getting...
about automating the verification now.
But you're not getting the end-to-end, right? It, just because you're running show command on one device, if you've got five devices in the path, is it actually working?
So no, if you're an engineer worth your salt, you would have done that across the network, obviously. But I think the big point here is the model gives you that end-to-end. And I think someone who was tearing apart your model could say, yeah, but I don't have to have, you know, flow data necessarily to demonstrate that we've got compliance with intent. Well, I guess, okay, well, I'm sorry, I'm thinking out loud here. This is an interesting thought exercise. If you look at what Veriflow does, part of the magic there is to demonstrate mathematically every possible flow flows through the model in an expected way. So, sure, okay, I'll go with that. All right, so that's your level two. So we've got level zero manual. Level one, we've done some automation. Level two, we're introducing modeling and getting visibility into our network with model and how data flows through that model. How do we go beyond that?
Well, now you've got to realize something from that visibility. So now you have to analyze the data. That's a combination of configuration, architecture, flow levels, path changes, device issues. And you've actually got to realize what that means. So not only are you saying, I'm going to do data analysis on the visibility tooling, I now have to generate some sort of awareness. So I'm going to use machine learning to build models and know that what if this happens in the network, then this is something that's happened. So I'm now getting automated, self-realized information to me. So hang on, this router's gone down. That's why. And now the paths have changed into this. You need to go and get that router fixed. Or you've got a brownout. Your SFP module is now reporting a high level of errors. I can realize that. I can see the errors. I can analyze all the data, not just from the device, but all the devices around it.
So I would describe this as action items that result from changes in the network state. The network state's changed, so part of the closed loop is what do I do now that network state is different as related to the ultimate intent of the network? If a link goes down, if a neighbor adjacency goes down, if a device goes away or is underperforming, what do I do with that?
Okay, and the other side of this is a static analysis where the network architect can come along and go, I want to see my mean time to failure on all of the devices in my network and get a report from one, you know, showing you the least, the devices that have failed the most to the best. Because today we don't have that. And the question about mean time to failure and mean time to repair is how do you classify that data? And if you can do deeper data analysis and then build an awareness around, oh, power supply failures or CPU failures or line card failures, or, you know, we had this many SFP modules. Well, the question is, what brand of SFP modules failed? So how do you realize that without doing some sort of manual data analysis? What we want is automated awareness or automated data analysis to come out of that. All right. So that leads on into step four, which is reactive and self-aware, or as I called it, predictive self-operation. So what happens now is I've now got automation, automated configuration, automated change. I've got visibility. I can do this modeling. I can test the flows in real time. I've got this awareness of what's happening in the network, and I've got models that – so this is all going to go take a 10 years, 20 years, whatever, right? But this is like a pathway towards true intent. So now I'm looking at the network starts to react and is self-aware. It says, hang on, that SFP module is failing. I know that because I can do the analysis, and I know from data analysis and modeling and learned experiences from the network that I now need to route traffic around that failed SFP module, which is causing me a brownout or a gray failure, as they sometimes call it. So now you've got this gray area. So now the network goes, I will automatically start reconfiguring myself to route traffic around that failure. And the network has become self-aware, but it's reactively self-aware. It's not autonomous. It knows within fairly tightly constrained models that if this happens, then I can do this without any human intervention. So I can respond to temporal state or like transient state inside of the network, overloaded, failed SFP module, a device which is, you know, flapping routes for some reason. There's a bug. This CPU is overloaded. Therefore, I need to start. Things are going wrong. You know,
I mean, if you just we take a step back through, you know, history, and you look at what routing protocols do, and the fact that there are metrics and measurements and so on, and then the act of convergence. When network state changes, the act of convergence is that circuit's no longer a path that's available to me, and therefore I'm going to reroute. But it's very simplistic, right? It's very limited. There's a very finite amount of situations that a routing protocol can react to. So what you're describing here is something that's on a can take in a much larger number of variables and make decisions in the context of intent. The network's supposed to perform like this. It no longer is because this thing has changed on the network, as you mentioned, a whole variety of things. CPU is too high. A gray failure, like a circuit that's dropping packets. And now I as the network am going to react to that situation and bring the network back into compliance with the intended state.
Think about overlay networks where you actually don't know what the underlying state is. If you're just using neighbor protocols like OSPF to detect if the neighbor is up or down, you're going to fail. Even BFD is not going to give you a brownout situation because BFD packets are prioritized across the links, right? So if your underlying overlay, if the network overlay that you're using over some other internet or whatever it is, and packets start to drop, you can't just use traditional mechanisms to detect that gray failure. You have to have something far more advanced. You need to be modeling the path failure so that you know that it's going to happen. You need to have the data analysis showing you that brown, you know, packets beyond 5% are being dropped on a given link. Therefore, I need to react and do something with the overlay to divert traffic somewhere else. So the final level.
So then, what's the final step?
The human operator is not needed for anything. We're all unemployed. so basically, at this point, it's the network becomes self-training and self-operating. And what I think the key here is self-operating. That is, design and administration and key factors are all handled by humans, but humans are not part of the operational day-to-day process. The software that sits in control of these systems actually does all of the day-to-day stuff itself. So if there's a failed unit, it automatically wakes up and sends somebody out with a new unit to replace it. If there's a patch that needs to be fitted, it can calculate the risk and says, this is a small patch. You know, the human has said, I trust this vendor with an 80% level of certainty to deliver a patch that actually doesn't crash everything.
You're getting into, at this stage, what I spent a lot of time talking about at Interop May 2017, which is if you follow autonomous operations and automation to its end conclusion, then in theory, you should be able to have a network that is entirely programmatically monitored and maintained by software, where we've put enough intelligence into the network and how it is supposed to behave that software can handle all these eventualities. And if it's been engineered according to some kind of a standard, some kind of a spec, which is always the weak part, because we all engineer snowflakes as opposed to some kind of standard or predictable network, then we're at a place where why do you have to have humans involved other than to manually replace physical objects that need to be replaced? Wouldn't software just handle all of
it? Think about how complex networks are going to get over the next 10 years, right? It's not going to stay the same. You're not going to have private WAN bandwidth. You're going to have firewalls. You're going to have IoT devices. You're going to have edges that are blown out to the wazoo. You're going to have, we're seeing crypto keys being deprecated, like fundamental technologies, like we saw the crack thing go on this week where WPA2 has a vulnerability. Mm-hmm. You're going to need to be able to be patching on a daily sort of a basis with it. And you can't do that if it's human managed or human operated. It has to be almost autonomous, just without you doing anything. And we're going to have much more complex networks. Even in the enterprise, you're going to have devices. Users are going to have tablets and smartphones and maybe laptops and desktops. How do you secure all of those? How do you keep the networks for all of those? How do you manage all of those cloud resources? How do you communicate with all the VPNs between when all your customers are connected on the VPNs? So let's say today, most of your accounting data sits inside of your premises. What happens when all of that moves into the cloud or all of your accounting people are talking to other to transfer funds between them? What about when we see these blockchains and things like Bitcoin, when transactions are starting to put onto Bitcoin blockchains? How are you going to monitor the networking for all of that? So this is why I think he's going to drive this multiple phased approach to intent, where effectively we're going to work towards autonomous and self-aware. But what I'm trying to lay out here is there's some intermediate steps that we're going to go through before we get there. And you should be, well, maybe it's a bit arrogant, but I think these are the ways I see it as this is how we're going to get there. We're going to go through automation with some scripting, then some enhanced visibility. Then we're going to go into data analysis, which is going to build some awareness for us. Then we go into reactive network configuration, where it's, the system is quasi self-aware and can react to the changes. And then ultimately it becomes autonomous and self-aware, and how humans just not a part of the day-to-day operation.
Yeah, it is going to be slow, though, because we're so mired down in the way we do things today, and you know, the unique vendor solutions that are offered, where it's not an industry-wide solution, it's a, you know, unique vendor offering. We're seeing so much fragmentation in the IETF and the different standards that are there and how things should be done, and competing interests and politics that make it slow to move standards through. And so I suspect that as these sorts of changes come up, it's going to be in bursts. We're going to be here for a while at this plane, you know, maybe you're level three. And then some startup's going to come up with a way to drive things ahead that's going to displace the standard way we've done things, and get everyone's brains are going to have to be, okay, I'm cool with this, you know, and then move on. I don't know that networking is going to survive in the way that it has, where there's been all this interoperability and standardization. There's going to be islands of technology that do things in a particular way with some sort of commonality that allow them to exchange data in the middle, perhaps.
Well, I think we're seeing some of the things about, I don't think networking is going to be a standalone career like it has been. So the silo is breaking down.
That's very much so.
Yeah. And we're seeing, I think the clearest example of that I can see today is this Istio.io, which is a sidecar proxy. It's fundamentally what I would think of as a load balancer. And these people are actually building that into their DevOps apps. So what they're saying is they're now saying, well, I'm going to build a container that does this. If I want to bring a new one on board, I build a second container next to it. And then I use the Istio to divert 1% of traffic into the new one to test it and see if it works. Right. Well, that's a load balancer. By any imagination that I have, I would have done that with load balancing and have done for the last 20 years. You know, here's the new app that the companies just pushed when I used to work for online companies. And we divert 5% of traffic into it and then sit next to the phones waiting to hear if people whined about it, you know, if it wasn't working right. And that was how we worked. Well, now these people are writing that function as just a piece of the app. So, you know, when they click the DevOpsy button and deploy it, there's the sidecar proxy with the load balancer, and they're using that for visibility and packet counts and performance monitoring and a whole bunch of, you know.
Yeah, and to go back to my interop presentation, I mean, I think one of the things that's driving this is just what you're describing here, this need to be integrating networking into a much larger automated and orchestrated whole, where it's like, hey, guys, we don't have time for silos. This is a system that all needs to work together. And therefore, we've got to have networking automated, because as soon as we deploy this application that has these networking requirements, we're going to expect to be able to deploy it and have all of the networking functionality be automated as well. So that's, I don't see how that's not the future. And I don't see how the future of a technologist is not, call it full stack if you want, or I guess multi-silo is something I like as a way to describe people that have a lot of technical expertise across a lot of what were previously separate disciplines and functioned as silos and as islands within their technology organizations, and into, we're all in this together and we all got to understand how everything works together because it's all so tightly interdependent. We can no longer afford to live in our little bubbles of technology and throw things over the wall at one another. It's which we've talked about that so much. I don't want to just keep talking about that again and again because it's such a common theme on packet pushers. Now everyone's
okay. So if you're still listening now, I wrote a blog post. It's on packet pushers. It's in the membership system. Membership is free. We are looking to grow the membership system over time. So some of our content, especially some of the deeper stuff like this, where I explain all of this in details, and the links to that will be in the show notes. If you want to read about those six levels, follow the link in the show notes. And maybe you can argue with me, because I'd like to get some validation that I'm not a crazy nut job, although I suspect I actually might be.
Let's wrap up the show right there, Greg, on you being a crazy nut job. If you've listened this deep, you're over 70 minutes in, and thanks a lot for listening to us today. We are the Packet Pushers, at Greg Farrow and Ethan Banks. You can find this and many more of our fine, free technical podcasts, along with the rest of the Packet Pushers team, Drew Conroy Murray, Chris Wall, Scott Lowe, and other folks. Fine guests, world-class, literally world-class people that we find that are the best at what they do in all sorts of technology disciplines. And that is all at packetpushers.net. We're on Twitter, at Packet Pushers. You can follow us on LinkedIn. We're on Facebook, if you'd like to give us a like. Rate us on Apple Podcasts. We would appreciate that. That helps boost our ratings and let even more people know that Packet Pushers on this and our many other podcast channels exists. Last but not least, remember that too much technology would never be enough.